Now, bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades, this is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
It is no secret that California, and specifically the city of Los Angeles, has a crisis involving homelessness. It's everywhere. We don't need a study. We see it with our own eyes. And we have gone to our wallets at the polls to vote at the county level and the city level, Measure H and Triple H, to provide funding to deal with this problem. But the problem remains, if you're going to create housing for the homeless, where is it? Because not a lot of communities actually want homeless shelters in their neighborhoods. To talk to us about this thicket of issues, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show City Attorney Mike Fuhrer. Good morning, Mr. Fuhrer. How are you?
Doug, it's always great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. So you're proposing, we have a homeless czar, but you're proposing that we also require a homeless field general. What would that position entail?
Well, let's be clear. In Los Angeles now, there is the city and the county. Each have different responsibilities, and each have a staff member who is a point person on homelessness. And they're talented people. There's a lot of goodwill and a lot of good effort underway. But if there were a major hurricane or an earthquake here in Los Angeles, we would be having someone, the equivalent of a top-ranked FEMA director, coming in, being accountable for delivering on the ground. The key for us needs to be execution. And I think in the city of Los Angeles, we need to have someone who is at that level. A senior level point person who is in charge of directing implementation, executing on the ground. And in every neighborhood around the city, we have, two things are true at least. One, there is homelessness that is prevalent throughout Los Angeles. And two, as you pointed out, there are voters who have agreed to commit themselves financially to resolving this crisis. But at the same time, we haven't seen a lot of actual action on the ground that eliminates key homeless issues, and we have to be doing that now. There is an agreement, a broad agreement, that we should be siting what's called permanent supportive housing throughout the city. That's housing that includes services that address each homeless person's specific needs. But in the meantime, even as we progress toward fulfilling that goal, we need to be getting bridge housing right now. We need to be having safe storage places for homeless people right now. There are places where people ought to be able to park if they're living in their cars safely right now. We need more clean, safe bathrooms right now. It's that kind of execution, that sense of urgency, that intensity that I think we need to be bringing to the fore in the city of Los Angeles today.
Now, in the LA Times, the LA Daily News, a version of the story on this topic, they write, Fuhrer said this person, meaning the field general, would tackle the problem of potential community opposition to facilities serving the homeless, such as storage areas and temporary housing. So, and this gets to one of the most difficult issues, because while we agree that we've got to do something and we've committed to do a lot financially, there's not a lot of people, including myself, that would want to have a homeless facility in our neighborhood, because it attracts people who are homeless. It adds to blight, and that's certainly a fear that people have. And people are very protective, especially given how expensive housing is in this area. They want to protect their investment. They want to protect the quality of life in their neighborhoods. And I know that you could make the argument that, look, the homeless are in back alleys and living in green spaces and under freeway overpasses in your neighborhoods now. It's better to have them actually housed. But I guess my concern is, are we going to create a position that would essentially force this into neighborhoods without the community's input?
That's not good leadership. Good leadership would be to galvanize people, identify where the community can come together to try to locate places that people agree would be appropriate places and convince others. I will say, I've been trying to do some of this now. I have, for the last number of months, been going to stakeholders throughout Los Angeles. Folks you know, Doug, the Valley Alliance of Neighborhood Councils, the Sherman Oaks homeowners, West Side groups, the business community like the Chamber of Commerce. And in each of these contexts, I have been saying, I know there are many issues you want to discuss today. There might be issues of land use or traffic, really important issues. But tonight, I've said, or this morning, I want to talk about homelessness. In particular, I'm saying in each of these contexts, who will be a champion for the siting of homeless services and housing in your community? I don't mean in the middle of a single-family neighborhood block. I get the fact that in Los Angeles, one's home is one's investment for a lifetime. This is one's retirement plan. There's no other place. You can't diminish people's property values. But as you pointed out, there are homeless people in communities throughout the city. When I was on the city council maybe 15, 20 years ago, it was possible to say this is a Skid Row problem or maybe a Venice problem. It is no longer possible to say this is someone else's concern. It is everyone's concern. And what's been fascinating, Doug, is as I make these presentations, which I admit carry political risk, the response has been overwhelmingly favorable. Now, it would be different and harder, I think, were I having these conversations and there were a specific location on the table, because that would really get people to focus on that block.
Right. That's always where the rubber hits the road is once – again, this is one of these situations where theoretically everybody is on the same page. But once you get to a specific plan, there's always pushback. And traditionally, it's been the city council members – who would be having to answer to their constituents. And I guess that's the concern. Does this new position basically absolve,
It can't be so. It can't be so. It has to be, as I said, good leadership goes into a community, goes to other officials, and says, we have a common problem. Let's not identify all the reasons to say no. Let's find ways to say yes. You have legitimate concerns. Let's put them on the table. Let's sort through them. Let's work on this together as a team, not shove this down someone's throat. That latter approach is not what we need. I believe very strongly that we have the intellect and the talent and the experience and the goodwill to make this happen, but we need to be executing in a much more focused way. And you take council members, there may be moments where I might disagree myself with situations. For example, in Councilman Wiesar's district, in the 14th district, there is a proposal for the siting of a permanent supportive housing location there. It's a proposal that I think if there's any way it should happen, it can happen. It should happen. It's been bottled up. It is sitting there. I disagree with that. And it's okay. Disagreement is okay here, but what's not okay is gridlock. What's not okay is just perpetuating the status quo that is eroding the quality of life and public safety in every neighborhood of Los Angeles. And I will say, in my own situation as a city attorney, we are going way beyond the traditional role of a city attorney. We have these marvelous homeless citation clinics where we bring all kinds of services from Hep A vaccines and shots to food and haircuts and showers, and the ability to say to homeless people in these locations, we will help get rid of the citations and fines and warrants that are preventing you from getting a place to live or a job or housing, but you have to perform a community obligation in a service location like a housing program or a mental health or a job training program so you can eliminate these things. And we have turned people's lives around. We are going to send mobile teams into communities as a prosecutor before anyone has touched the justice system, drug rehabilitation, mental health, and physical health services, because we know the system right now isn't working in the criminal justice context. We should go in there before that happens. I'm trying to lead an effort to expand on a county program to convert motels, whose business models may no longer exist throughout the city, into housing for homeless people, because those motels already exist. There's already land. There's already a structure there. Let's take advantage of it. We're trying to tackle patient dumping, homeless patient dumping. You know, we've sued many hospitals with regard to allegations of dumping homeless patients on the street to change their practices. We're trying to preserve affordable housing by suing landlords who are taking affordable units off the market and replacing them with short-term rentals illegally. There's all kinds of work we're doing. It's not enough. We need to be taking this to the next level, each of us.
City Attorney Mike Fuhrer, there's so much material here to cover in these short segments. We'll have to continue this conversation. Thanks for coming on and talking to us about it.
Always my pleasure, Doug.
I want to circle back to a story, obviously in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein catastrophe. The nation is having a long overdue conversation about sexual harassment. We're seeing all kinds of dominoes toppling. The latest is Mark Halperin, formerly of ABC News, that went over to NBC News and now apparently is out. And even old George H.W. playing grabby ass at photo ops, which is very sad. But an interesting piece of legislation has been proposed in Sacramento by State Senator Connie Leva, who's a Democrat from Chino.
And this bill would ensure that sexual predators can be held accountable for their actions and hopefully prevent them from victimizing others. And that is, it bans non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements, when it comes to sexual assault. To talk to us about it right now on the Newsmaker line is California State Senator Connie Leyva. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. I really wanted to talk to you about this because I think this is a great idea. We've talked to a couple of legal experts about what the downside might be. And one of the concerns is that if you take the confidentiality agreements off the table, everybody's going to go to trial because that's an attractive feature to go to arbitration and settle things prior to trial. And the courts are already crowded. But I would weigh that against the upside, which is removing the cloak of the stealth that has allowed predators to continue to prey.
Right. The downside is that women are being sexually harassed every day. It's not a Hollywood problem. It's not a Silicon Valley problem. It is a societal problem. And until we allow these women to come forward and until we ban secret settlements that say, if you have enough money, you can buy your way out of this, I don't think we change anything.
Well, I would agree with you. In fact, if anything, I would even expand this in another area. Because this has been what started out as a pet peeve has metastasized into a feral peeve of mine. And that is, non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements, when government agencies get sued. Because,
right.
Like the city of Los Angeles gets sued all the time. And then we're told that because of attorney-client privilege, we're not allowed to know the details. But we're the client. The city council's not the client. It's our money. We ought to be able to know what the settlement is.
Well, my legislation would propose this would be for public and private sector.
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction. Now, had we had a law like this on the books in California, Roger Mahoney, the what I think is disgraced former cardinal of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, who stonewalled the investigation into the sex abuse of children for many, many years, and paid a lot of people off. But once again, because of non-disclosure agreements, it made it possible for the predators to be just moved from parish to parish.
Exactly. And that's what's happening all across the state, all across the nation. It happens at McDonald's. It happens everywhere. We don't take sexual harassment or sexual assault seriously enough. And I can't say it enough times. If you have enough money, then you can buy your way out of this. So if we make it against the law, then we take a step in the right direction to make sure that we stop these actions. Imagine if this law had been enacted and Harvey Weinstein had sexually assaulted one woman. Maybe no other women would have had to be subjected to that.
We're talking with California State Senator Connie Leyva, and you can follow her on Twitter at Senator Leyva, L-E-Y-V-A. You were one of the people who pushed for limits on statutes of limitation on some of these sexual assault cases, if I remember correctly. Do I have that correct?
Yes, I authored SB 813 last year, which eliminated the statute of limitation on rape. The governor signed it into law last year.
Based on what you've heard, is it likely that we could see criminal charges filed against Harvey Weinstein?
It really depends on when the assaults took place, if it was harassment, if it was assault, or if it was rape. But I would think so. I would certainly hope so.
Now, what's the status on this bill right now, and where do you see it going?
So we'll introduce the bill in January when we get back in session. My hope is that this bill, as with the statute of limitation on rape bill, it went through both houses unopposed with bipartisan support. And I would hope that this bill would do the same and get the same sort of reception.
Well, it certainly, in theory, makes a world of sense to me. I never understood how, especially, when you're talking about physical assault, you're talking about a felony. This is a crime. So
yes.
How these things get solved as civil matters has always been confusing to me anyway. They shouldn't be civil matters. They're criminal cases.
That's exactly right, and they should be treated as such. And we need the men's help as well in this. We need men calling out other men saying, hey, that's not appropriate. You can't talk to a woman like that. You can't do that to a woman. So this is something we can all work together on.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I also think that, you know, it's tough, though. And, you know, some of your colleagues in Sacramento, some of your female colleagues in Sacramento, 140 of them signed a letter talking about issues that they have dealt with in the councils of government itself. So as you correctly point out, this is not just a Hollywood issue. It's the Hollywood angle gets covered because we're talking about very famous people. But it's in, you know, I've always said, give somebody a whistle and a clipboard and they reveal their true character. You know, you give somebody a little bit of power.
Yeah, so true.
True.
You know, so it can be in any aspect of society. But the bottom line here is that it takes real courage when your career or your economic livelihood is on the line. If you're a waitress and you work at a restaurant and your shift supervisor is essentially holding better tables hostage for sexual favors or whatever scenario you want to paint. If you're a young politician and your party leader, and I'm using this just as a fictitious example, but if a top powerful person in your own party is engaged in behavior that really falls into this category, do you want to run the risk of having your career terminated and reprisals that can come? Same thing for a police officer who drops a dime on a dirty colleague and ends up on the rat squad.
Right. Well, and that's why we have to change this culture of harassment and rape that we live in. This is, I hope we're at a turning point, and I hope that finally in 2017, we are saying enough is enough, and we are going to believe women. We are going to not allow this to happen. All the scenarios you just mentioned happen every single day. And like I just said, I'm hoping now finally in 2017, we're waking up and we're all going to take a part in this and we're all going to say no more.
All right. Listen, thank you for coming on and talking to us about it. We'll continue to follow the story as it works its way through the legislature.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
All right. California State Senator Connie Leyva. You know, when Penny and I flew back on Sunday night from JFK, we landed at LAX. We got in early. We got in about 25 minutes early.
Oh, how long did you wait for a gate?
Well, that's what made this newsworthy. We actually went right to a gate.
Really?
That's unbelievable, because I know that LAX is famous for gate shortages. You know, they congratulate themselves on getting you in early, and then you sit for 45 minutes past your arrival time because there is no place to put the plane.
Yep.
That's just one of the many complaints. But today, NBC4, our news partner, investigative reporter Joel Grover, is exposing the worst airports and airline delays in the nation. And joining us right now is Joel Grover. Good morning, Joel. How are you?
Morning, Doug. And that is what we call breaking news. You got to LAX early and didn't have to wait for a gate.
I know. That's unprecedented.
I think we're going to leave the 11 o'clock news with that story.
That's the first time it's happened to me in about 10 years.
Yes. Anyway, we have a great story on tonight, and we're coming up on the busiest travel season of the year, the holiday season, and I think before people book their flights, if they haven't, they want to watch our report tonight because we crunched the numbers. We looked at 9 million flights in and out of U.S. airports for the last year and a half, and we came up with the airports that have the most flight delays, the airlines that have the most flight delays, the routes that are delayed the most, the best and worst days of the week and the year to travel. A lot of really helpful information, and there are definitely some patterns here. What do you think is the worst? I'm not going to give it all away, or else no one's going to want to watch tonight at 11, and this is a really good, important story, but what do you think is the worst airport in the country for delays?
O'Hare.
I'm going to say,
O'Hare.
Newark's Liberty Airport.
Oh. Or what is one of us right?
Well, I didn't get
it. Said Liberty.
I said Newark's Liberty Airport.
And I said O'Hare.
You're both wrong.
Uh-huh.
Like you're a little closer, right?
Atlanta?
LAX is the worst airport in the nation for flight delays. One out of every flight out of LAX is delayed. And a delay is defined as leaving at least 15 minutes late.
One out of every four.
Newark is the second worst.
Yeah, I know that Newark
is. SFO is the third.
Yeah.
And for more, you're going to have to watch the story.
Now, here's, this is a little unusual. The reason I didn't pick LAX is that you would think that LAX, San Diego, Phoenix, the dry, warm weather places aren't going to have weather delays.
Right.
So what the hell
That's
is
why
the problem?
O'Hare used to be bad.
And by the way, one of you mentioned Atlanta. Atlanta Hartsfield is the busiest airport in the nation,
right?
And they have far fewer flight delays than LAX
and worse weather. Yeah. So, what's the cause?
Is it
the layout of the airport? This is the thing that I observed, Joel. LAX is squished into a tiny spit of land given the size and volume of air traffic. I mean, you fly to Chicago and you get into the rent-a-car terminals and start driving. 15 minutes later, you're still driving around O'Hare Airport. It's got elbow room.
Right.
It's got room to grow.
O'Hare, Dallas, Atlanta, Phoenix. Lots of land to expand there. LAX does not have as much land, but LAX just has really been behind in expanding to keep up with air traffic. They, as you said, they do not have enough gates. I know I fly in and out of LAX a lot, and I cannot tell you, like you, how many times I have landed and waited a long time for a gate. So LAX admits the problem is partly not enough gates. They put a nice face on this and said, we are expanding. But the only expansion they could tell us about was one new concourse with 12 gates that'll be hopefully completed by 2020. So 12 more gates in an airport the size of LAX. Tell me how much that's really going to ease the problem.
Yeah.
There's a couple other issues here, though, why flights in a lot of the big airports are delayed. The airlines do not have airplanes and flight crews on reserve if there is a mechanical problem.
Right.
They got to sit there and try and fix the problem. You know, there used to be government rules that said you need this many planes and this many crew on standby on reserve if a plane can't fly. Doesn't happen anymore.
Well, going outbound to New York, I was flying JetBlue. And we boarded. The plane was an hour delayed for boarding. And then once we boarded, we hit the taxiway and then turned around and went back to the gate because of mechanical problems and arrived 5.5 hours late. But at least mercifully, they let us, they gave us the option of getting off the plane when we returned to the gate.
Right.
So, you know, back in the bad old days, you were a hostage of the airlines. They wouldn't let anybody off the plane. And you had those terrible stories of people trapped there for 11, 12 hours.
Yeah.
Right. Everybody has their favorite travel nightmare story. We have a piece of video in this story. It has been on a few media outlets in the past, but not very widely seen. It speaks to the frustration we all feel. A woman whose flight was delayed for hours, and she lost it and went ballistic on the gate agents. You don't want to do that anymore because everyone's got their cell phone and they'll record it and they'll give the video to the news media. But you got to see this piece of video because you'll go, oh my gosh, that's exactly how I feel. I don't know if I would scream in a crowd of 100 people, but it's an amazing piece of video. I do want to point out we're going to give, we hope, a lot of useful information to travelers on how to avoid flight delays because there are some things you can do.
It'll be on NBC4, investigative reporter Joel Grover. You can follow on Twitter at JoelNBCLA. Thanks so much, Joel. We'll all be watching.
Tonight at 11. Thanks, you guys, for having me on again. Always
happy to have you on.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10.
95.5 KLOS.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
Steve Bannon had a blistering tirade against the Republican incumbency. We'll talk with Sean Steele, who's a member of the Republican National Committee, about that, as the Republican Party continues to be at war with itself. And, of course, this war threatens to torpedo one of the president's principal campaign promises and legislative agendas, which is tax reform. The Senate did pass a $4 trillion budget, which should open the way for a tax reform bill to come through. But there are obviously great complexities. The Democrats, by the way, in the Senate failed in their first attempt to save the state and local tax deduction, which, by the way, will be death for us in California and other high tax states like New York and Illinois.
It's like we got to pay twice
if that goes through. To talk to us about it right now, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show one of our favorites. He is the congressman from the Burbank, Glendale, Pasadena area. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the show, Congressman Adam Schiff. Good morning, Congressman. How are you?
Good, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. the U.S. tax system is so complex, as we know, that we have to hire people in order to stay in compliance with the law. And it's ever shifting. As I remember, President Obama, as well as his Republican predecessor, talked about the corporate tax rate in America is too high. It's one of the highest in the world. And we should lower it to make American business more competitive. President Trump wants to do that as well. When you see that kind of bipartisan agreement, why is it that something like at least that aspect of the tax code can't be addressed? It seems like there would be broad support for it.
I think there is broad support for it. The challenge is, you know, the rate on its surface appears high, but many companies are able to take advantage of different deductions, some of them very special interest and tailored to certain industries. And as a result, only some companies pay the actual rate. Most pay a lot less, and it's very inequitable. Sometimes it just depends on whether your industry has the lobbying power to get a special provision. So if we could get rid of a lot of those special provisions and bring the overall rate back and simplify the tax returns, that would be great. If we could simplify individual returns, that would be great, too. But as you might imagine, when you actually start looking at what deductions you have to get rid of to bring the overall rate down, that's when it gets much more difficult.
You know, I understand that we have the constitutional right to petition Congress for the redress of grievances. And through that sentence in the First Amendment, we end up with lobbyists. and everybody, at least it has been my experience, Congressman, that we define special interest money as anybody's money who isn't ours. Everybody thinks that everybody else's lobbyist is the problem. But that is kind of the problem, that with all of these different K Street lobbyists getting their fingers in the pie, it muddles the water on things like health insurance policy and tax policy, et cetera, et cetera. And oftentimes, I think the American people feel like everybody's being represented except them.
Well, that's absolutely true. And you look at all the barnacles that have grown up on the tax code, and you wonder, where did that come from? Some are very, very specific to certain industries, or almost look like they're specific to certain companies. It's deeply frustrating. People feel like, okay, I don't have somebody in there advocating for me. And as a result, I'm really not getting any tax relief, and my taxes may go up. If you look at the middle class in California right now, if this provision goes through to basically remove that deduction for state and local taxes, a lot of middle-income families in California, millions of them, are going to get a whopping tax increase from this so-called reform. They're going to end up paying up to 40% more because that deduction is worth an awful lot. We do have high taxes in California, and we use it to invest in the state. I don't think it's escaped anyone's notice that this is basically a blue state tax.
Yep.
I don't think the president would be entertaining this, or the GOP Congress, if it were most disproportionately affecting red states. And we shouldn't be making tax policy that way.
We're talking with Congressman Adam Schiff, and you can follow him on Twitter at Rep. Adam Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F. It does seem punitive because it falls on states that didn't vote for the president. But more importantly, it really, to me, tees up the multiple layers of taxation. It's become a cliche. It's a longtime cliche that, you know, those of us who are yammering on AM talk radio, we always scream about taxes. This is what we do. It's like the air we breathe. But when we talk about taxes, the federal taxes are just one layer of taxation. Then you have state. Then you can have county. You can have municipal. You can have school taxes. You can have special parks districts. You can have car registration fees that they don't call taxes, but in fact are. And then point of purchase sales taxes. And then you have ballot measures for transportation taxes and homelessness and all of these issues that maybe any one of them individually. Wonderful ideas. But boy, when you add it up, it's a big bite. And this is what I find so frustrating. We have a $4 trillion budget. We have a $16 trillion and growing deficit. And nobody's happy. Everybody keeps saying we don't have enough money for infrastructure, for the military, for schools, for healthcare, for whatever it is. And I don't know how that's possible. We could have a $16 trillion deficit and we still don't like what we've bought with it.
Well, and, you know, people are going to like it a lot less if this plan goes through in the way it's structured, because it's going to make our deficit and debt that much worse. The prevailing philosophy behind this outline so far is it will pay for itself. And that's a wonderful sales pitch, but historically that's never proven to be true. It may be a good idea to reduce taxes, and certainly on certain people who are paying a disproportionate share, we should reduce taxes. On companies that are paying the full freight, we should reduce taxes. And we should make sure that companies don't get away with paying no tax because they have good lobbyists. But the reality is they don't pay for themselves. And you do have to offset a reduction somewhere with an increase somewhere else if it's going to be revenue neutral, as they claim this will be. Otherwise, we're basically borrowing from our kids. And I'd hate to see us do more of that. They're already in debt enough with their college loans.
Well, I agree. There used to be the pejorative that was thrown at Democrats was they're tax and spend liberals. But that's been supplanted with borrow and spend Republicans, which is worse, because we are, in fact, going to the mall with our great-grandkids' credit card. And that's something that we did not do in earlier generations. But we're in a weird situation where if you cut anything, you're demagogued as hating fill in the blank. And at some point, we cannot continue to just put colas into every piece of legislation and have entitlements that grow exponentially without some kind of cost controls.
Well, we are going to have to deal with that. And, you know, I look back to where we were back at the Clinton end of the Clinton administration when we had balanced the budget and we were getting down to the point of being debt free. Now, we've had two very long wars since then. We went through a terrible recession that really decreased revenues dramatically, and we passed tax cuts. And the combination of all of that means that our fiscal picture is getting worse and worse and worse in terms of this mountain of debt. And we're going to have to deal with that. We're either going to have to go to war a heck of a lot less often and of shorter duration, and we're going to have to spend less on a variety of other things, or we can't afford to further reduce revenues to the government because we're just ballooning our debt.
Well, the president wants to see a bill on his desk before Thanksgiving. Is that possible?
It's possible. I just hope it's a good one, because right now what they're proposing is to lower corporate rates for some companies and raise individual taxes to pay for it. So you and I and others that itemize our returns in California are going to pay more, a lot more, thousands more, if they do away with this state and local tax deduction. There's also a discussion, which the president just said he also doesn't agree with, but the GOP is looking at limiting the ability to put money into 401ks. So we're going to basically affect people's retirement in order to bring down the corporate rate, and I just don't think that's fair.
All right. To be continued, obviously. Thank you for coming on and talking to us about this. We always appreciate your time.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Doug.
Okay. Adam Schiff, Congressman. Adam Schiff, we've always been able to have good conversations with Adam Schiff and Tom McClintock, one on the right, one on the left. And it's important to hear from both sides on this. But Congressman Schiff is 100% right, folks. The tax bill, as it's currently written, crushes Californians and New Yorkers and folks in Illinois, Connecticut, New Jersey, all the high tax states, because it eliminates the deduction for state and local taxes. And I got to tell you right now, if this goes unchallenged, if I don't care if you're a Republican, you better be hoping the Democrats win on that point. You better hope that the Democrats are triumphant, because you are not going to like Donald Trump's tax reform if that goes through unchanged. It's going to cost you dearly. And it could have a real impact on the value of your home. Because as those taxes go through the roof, it's going to make it harder to find buyers who can pay the freight on that.
Oh, boy. Hey, you ever wonder if they try to do the simplifying the tax code and they actually get all this stuff through, what would that do to the accounting industry? Would CPA go out of business?
Well, that's, you know, the whole idea of a flat tax where you just pay a flat 10% if you make $10,000 a year, you pay $1,000. If you make $10 million a year, you pay $1 million. I don't support a flat tax. I believe in a graduated income tax for the simple reality that if you make $10,000 a year, I do believe everybody should have skin in the game, even if you make very little.
Agreed.
You should pay for something so you understand that there's no such thing as government money. Everybody's got to have a piece, have skin in the game. But if you can't just have a flat tax and tax somebody who makes very little at the same rate as somebody who makes a vast fortune, because let's face it, if you're making $10 million a year and the government takes $1 million, you can scrape by on nine.
You
can get by on $9 million.
But it's going to be a little tough, but you can do it.
If you make $10,000 a year and the government takes $1,000 away, it's going to be a struggle to get by on $9,000 a year.
Exactly.
So that's why a graduated income tax is proportionate. But as I said, you know, the people that want to dismiss folks complaining about taxes don't add up all the taxes. It's not just the federal government. It's all these other taxes, the state, the county, the city, the schools, the libraries, the homeless tax, the transportation tax,
the
car registration fees, and point of purchase sales taxes. All of that stuff, man, you could be spending 70% of your income could be going out the door.
When you liberal them all that one by one by one, why aren't we going to the harbor right now and dump some tea?
Well, that's the other thing, too. This nation
Let's
was founded on a tax revolt, and it's part of the DNA of America.
All McIntyre in the Morning's Tea Party. Let's go overboard.
Well, that name has been co-opted already. Mm. And that's unfortunate. You see, the Tea Party people now, because everything is so polarized, it's sort of like now people think the Boston Tea Party was like a bad thing. No, the Boston Tea Party was the fuse that...
Ted Cruz ruined the Boston Tea Party.
Well, let's come up with something else then.
Ladies and gentlemen, Harvey Weinstein apparently is all better.
What?
He checked himself out of rehab.
God. Was he there for like a week?
Made a couple of phone calls.
Please.
And he's out. But boy, the issue is also out because people are identifying. People are emboldened now to step up to the plate and actually name their accusers. The latest is the director, James Toback, who's had all kinds of accusers come. I mean, like overnight, like 30 people.
Let me tell you, have you gone back? I read that 1989 story on him that they're all talking about. There was a story written about him in 1989 of all these women in this article. Oh, my gosh. Back then. Hello?
Yeah. No.
How come that wasn't a red flag back then?
But all of these things have been red flagged, including Corey Feldman.
Oh, yeah. He's been talking since he was a kid.
Who was molested as a child and was on. This has now become an infamous moment from Barbara Walters' career.
Yeah.
Where he was on with Barbara Walters talking about this. And she was saying, you're going to destroy Hollywood if you keep... You know, basically just shut up.
Yeah.
And once again, the institution protecting itself. And this is how.
And blaming the victim.
Yeah.
And then you got the New York Times expose that Bill O'Reilly apparently settled a suit from Lee's Wheel, who used to be on the show with him all the time, for $32 million. $32 million. And that's apparently in addition to the $13 million settlement checks that had been written previously. So what are we up to, $45 million?
Right. But I thought the $13 million was like for different women. This $32 million was just for lease. For
kind of loofah was he using on that one?
Right, and I was like, what happened to her? And then you said the what was the wording in her deal?
Yes, it was non-consensual sex.
Which means rape. I'm sorry, that's what that means.
It's
$32 million. Wow.
So this store, of course, Mr. O'Reilly is saying that it's a conspiracy, it's a hit job, it's
please.
A this, it's a that.
No, he paid out $32 million.
Well, we've had entirely too much fire in the state of California, and unfortunately, the weather forecast presents a challenge for the next couple of days. Very hot, up to 104, which means in the West San Fernando Valley at my house would be 138.
Yeah.
With high winds, these are the same conditions that, of course, caused such a terrible disaster in Northern California with 42 fatalities. This ranks alongside the 1991 Oakland Hills fire as the state's costliest blaze, both in terms of human life and the financial consequences could be devastating. The Oakland Hills fire costs more when you adjust for inflation, $2.7 billion. And what we've seen in Northern California could easily top $1 billion. To talk to us about this right now is the California State Insurance Commissioner. Pleasure to welcome back to the show, Dave Jones. Good morning, Mr. Jones.
Good morning.
This is a doozy. And those who are fortunate enough or had fire insurance
as a general rule, what kind of, I mean, fire insurance does not make, does not replace everything, even when you have it. When you don't have it, the consequences can be devastating.
So at this point, we know that there were something on the order of 8,000 structures destroyed in all of the fires throughout California. In Northern California alone, about 7,000 structures. So far, the insurers are reporting to us over $1 billion in claims have been filed. We urge people, when get insurance, to get replacement coverage and to carefully estimate the replacement cost of their home. I've actually issued a regulation requiring insurers to use a comprehensive methodology to estimate the replacement cost of your home, because people oftentimes don't understand that the replacement cost can be higher than the market value. Now, in addition to the structure, your contents, most homeowners insurance policies also have what's called additional living expense coverage, which covers your food, transportation, and lodging when you're forced out of the home. I've issued a request to insurers to expedite claims handling and start cutting checks up to 4 months, advance checks for that additional living expense coverage to get money into people's hands right away.
Now, the cost, what happens to the people who don't have insurance?
If you don't have insurance, you can apply for FEMA assistance. The maximum amount per household is only about $35,000, and few people get that much. And you can apply for a small business loan, something on the order of about $200,000 to rebuild your home. That's why we urge people to get insurance. If you don't have insurance, there's just simply not much federal or state assistance available to you.
Is this true also for earthquakes? Because, you know, this is something that I just recently bought earthquake insurance for our house, and we didn't have it, and the house had taken a bad hit in the Northridge earthquake. And this is something that, you know, we have earthquake drills, but a lot of people just say, well, you know, I'm going to roll the bones. You know, we haven't had an earthquake in so many years, but talk about devastation. If when the big one hits, this state is going to take a tremendous pounding, and the financial consequences could be profound.
That's right. It's not if, it's when. And we urge people to get residential earthquake insurance. It's offered by the California Earthquake Authority. And since I've been commissioner, we've been able to reduce the rates about 20%. You can adjust the deductible, lower deductible, higher premium, lower deductible. We've also made contents earthquake insurance available, so you can get to the replacement of the contents of your home if it's a minor earthquake before you have to get through the big deductible for the structure. But the simple reality is far too many Californians have earthquake insurance. And the same thing with regard to fires. There'll be very little FEMA or state assistance to rebuild your home. So we do urge people, particularly in areas where there's an earthquake, to get earthquake insurance. And those that are in areas of floods, get flood insurance. It's critically important to buy these insurance products to give you peace of mind, but also help you recover when the disaster strikes.
And, you know, we see these pictures on the news, whether it's tornadoes in the Midwest or floods in the Southeast and now the fires in Northern California. And it's very hard for people to absorb that as a reality that they could sometime encounter. But we saw things happen in these Northern California fires where, you know, tracked homes, entire neighborhoods were wiped out that weren't really built into the landscape. They weren't built into the, you know, the brush and into the hills where you are engaged in a higher risk just by the topography. And that's something that we rarely see happen. So it can happen. There's physical evidence of it right there in Northern California.
That's right. I personally visited Santa Rosa, Sonoma, and Napa, and the scenes of destruction and devastation are heartbreaking. I heard firsthand from fire victims their harrowing tales of escape and talked to folks who had lost loved ones. 42 deaths so far, and as the search and rescue teams make their way into harder-to-reach areas, sadly, we'll probably see that number increase. In Santa Rosa, whole neighborhoods were wiped out. These are suburban neighborhoods, 500-600 homes in each of these neighborhoods reduced to ash. I've never seen anything like it. It's like a photograph from a book about a war. The devastation was total and complete. And so, yes, we're entering a new normal in California where we're having more severe, more unpredictable, more frequent wildfires. And so people need to very, very seriously consider each year how much insurance they have, because no area is immune now. I've also been on site to make sure the insurers are out there paying claims. I issued a emergency order allowing them to move more people into the state. I've asked them to expedite claims handling. So far, $1 billion in claims have been filed. We anticipate that number could be four times as much. And those are just the insured losses. The uninsured losses, as you point out, are going to be even higher. So it's going to be a very, very difficult road to recover for these areas. It's going to take some time. But we're here to help people. If you have a issue with your insurance company, call us at 1-800-927-4357, and we go to bat for you. We encourage people to call their insurance agent first and foremost, call their insurance company. Don't sign a contract with some third party to help you. They'll take a piece of the settlement. You're far better off starting with your insurance company, then calling the Department of Insurance. And then, and only then, if you have some big dispute that's unresolved, you might consider getting third-party assistance.
Hey, listen, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about it. Important stuff. The California Insurance Commissioner, Dave Jones. Appreciate it, sir. More than one in five, 21% of Americans, don't save a single dime. And while about half of Americans do save, they don't save enough. But this is what's interesting. 38% of Americans say they don't save because they have too many other expenses. And the number two reason is really peculiar. Laziness.
Huh?
16% of Americans say they don't save because they haven't gotten around to it.
It's a whole thing. You got to open a savings account, and then you got to transfer the paycheck.
With, of course, millennials being among the most likely to cite this answer. Let's talk about it with Bankrate.com's chief financial analyst, Greg McBride. Greg, how are you?
Good morning, Doug. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. So there's a lot of reasons that people don't save, mostly because they don't make enough. The laziness is, and I thought that this was odd until I thought about it. And the reason, when you think about it, it's not that surprising, is look at how we use gift cards. People get these gift cards all the time, or they either buy them themselves or they're presented for birthday or a holiday. And an enormous, I mean, billions and billions of dollars a year goes unclaimed because people just forget about them. They throw them in a drawer and forget about them.
Yeah, and I think, that really kind of speaks to the problem about why people are having difficulty saving is you can't wait until the end of the month or, well, I'll get around to it, or, well, let me make sure after I get all the bills paid, if there's anything left, then I'll try to save. That's not a successful strategy. Those that are successful savers, they do it because they save first. They have the direct deposit from their paycheck into a dedicated savings account. They have an automatic withdrawal from their checking account going into savings or an investment account every month. It happens like clockwork, and it's just automatic. And then they force themselves to live on what's left. You live on less than you make. That's really the essence of building wealth over time. If you wait until the end of the month to try to save what's left over, nothing's going to be left over. And so with more than half of people saying either it's their expenses or just the fact they haven't gotten around to it that's keeping them from saving, it's like an easy way for half of Americans to rectify that situation and get some savings happening right away.
Well, the old argument, the old adage is pay yourself first. And that's what a lot of people don't have a concept of, that, it's one of the reasons that we have the rate of taxation that we do is the graduated is payroll withholdings. If people had to pony up the entire tax bill on April 15th, instead of having it taken out dribs and drabs as you go through the year, there would be pitchforks and torches in the street. They'd be stringing the politicians up from the nearest oak tree. But the same psychology applies to saving, that if you pay yourself first, if you have some kind of a savings payroll deduction, then, you start to build a nice nest egg, and it's out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, great example, because you're right. You don't notice it if it's you're saving in those just sort of drips and drabs automatically every payday on a regular schedule. That saving happens even before you roll out of bed on payday morning. Exactly. I mean, somebody, when they're thinking about saving, whether it's for long-term goals like retirement or short-term needs like emergency savings, and they think about how much they need, it sounds insurmountable, particularly when you're starting from zero. And we find about one in four Americans doesn't have any savings right now. But, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. And I think that's really the way to look at it from a savings standpoint. You know, make it happen automatically. That money builds on itself. And then it becomes self-reinforcing because, you know, you start to feel some progress. And inevitably people say, yeah, but every time I save some money, then something happens and it ends up wiping out the savings. That's proof that it's working because unplanned expenses are just a part of life. They're going to pop up. If you don't have savings to absorb that, it's going to end up on debt or something else doesn't get paid. At least if you have some savings, it absorbs that expense and you're only one paycheck away from starting to replenish the savings.
We're talking with Greg McBride, Bankrate.com's chief financial analyst, and Bankrate.com, of course, is the website. It's interesting that on a personal level, we talk about this all the time, but you know, when you look at government and how government spends money, they're no better at this on a massive grand scale. You know, the city of Los Angeles this year had to borrow money to pay legal settlements. So, you know, they always talk about having a rainy day fund or having some kind of a set aside for emergencies in government, and they rarely have that. But, you know, of course, the federal government has something we can only dream of. If they're short of money, they could always print more. We can't do that on a personal level.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, even the government, you know, the local and state governments, you know, we're the rainy day fund when they need
exactly
money. You know, basically, we get the bill for that. Well, as individuals at the household level, like you said, not only can we not print money, but, you know, we don't have somebody to pass the bill on to. Literally, the buck stops here with us. And so I think it's up to us to prioritize saving, making it as painless as possible by paying yourself first and then conditioning yourself to live on what's left. That's really the key. The people that are successful savers. And look, you know, we find that it's not a function of income primarily. We find that there are more households with income between $30,000 and $50,000 a year that are saving more than 10% of their incomes than those that make between $50,000 and $75,000 a year. So it's not purely a function of income. So that, you know, excuse of, well, I'll save when I make more money, that doesn't work either. You have to start now and you have to make it happen automatically. If you do that, then that habit stays as your earnings grow.
That is a big part of the problem because we are in a culture that encourages us to scratch every itch. And I think that all of us, I'm certainly not immune from this, struggle with making the distinction between wants and needs. Because, you know, we want lots of things and a lot of things are presented to us and it's very seductive and attractive and it looks like, wow, that'd be great. But there's a difference between that and something that you actually need. And we can go into debt easily pursuing wants at the expense of needs.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it was a great Saturday Night Live bit with Steve Martin one time, called Don't Buy Stuff You Can't Afford. And, about how the instant gratification and people just buying everything they want, putting it on credit and, you know, the need to sort of retrain yourself to don't buy what you can't afford. If you don't have money in savings, you can't afford to buy it. If you don't have the regular income to buy something, don't need it that bad. I think that's true. Those temptations to spend are everywhere. And that's all the more reason why you have to make the savings automatic, because otherwise it's just not going to happen.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, thanks so much for coming on with us. Appreciate it. Greg McBride, Bankrate.com. He's the chief financial analyst. Appreciate you being with us. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.